The views and opinions expressed by the following program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station or the Webster Rockhill Ministries, its management, or other host or underwriting sponsors. Programs presented on KWRHLP are for educational and entertainment purposes only.
Amanda LaPlante. You're listening to Get Real to Heal on KWRH 92.9 FM. And I am back with Dr. Caleb Boutwell-Lenars, MD of Catalyst Pain Management and Restorative Treatment Center in St. Louis, Missouri. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. So when we last talked, we were talking about testing and not guessing as it pertains to, especially in that conversation, food sensitivity.
Correct.
Yes. So... Well, we were talking about this. So we had some awesome conversation on the break, and my head is just full, and I'm super excited to get all of this knowledge out to you guys. So, all right, so we were talking about, again, MRT. So let's start with MRT versus some of the other forms of food testing,
sure.
Food sensitivity testing, if you wouldn't mind, because I wasn't particularly familiar with that one, but it seems to be more reliable and a better way of testing in many ways.
Right. So after vetting 4 or 5 different food sensitivity tests, including vetting them against commercially available ones, which patients would be able to get just online, of which I have done many, we finally settled on the MRT test for several reasons. The way the test works is a blood draw, and the blood that's taken is actually tested against essentially the antigens or the proteins, the chemical properties of certain foods. And what I liked about the MRT test is the scope of the foods that are tested, especially the ones that would be unanticipated. So, for example, my kryptonite foods currently are spinach and pumpkin. Also, cantaloupe, cardamom, strawberries, egg whites, things of that nature that are actually foods you eat. One of the things that I was seeing frequently with some of the other tests is that they would test against foods that I didn't even know how to pronounce. So, you know, just like, I like action items, you know, and I like to be able to come back to my patients telling them what they can and can't eat that were options to begin with. And, you know, so, and some of us eat stranger things than others, but certainly the applicability of that was very important. And I liked that it tested against so many foods because more often than not, what it gifted me and our practitioners the availability to do is to tell the patients what they actually could be eating that they might have assumed they couldn't because they were told that in general people are allergic to wheat, you know, and dairy, or not understanding the difference between even that, you know, a gluten sensitivity means wheat, barley, and rye, not just wheat, for example. So we appreciate the opportunity to put back on the plate things that people might have otherwise gotten rid of. So that's how the test works. Very simple. Blood draw, comes back results. It also results in different forms. So we get these scales of, is it a green food, a yellow food, or a red food? And in general, we of course want to avoid a red food and probably indefinitely at a minimum until future testing to see if the changes in your nutrition have actually done why we're doing this, which is it allows the gut most times to actually remediate itself. So instead of needing a drug or an anti, a proton pump inhibitor or an antacid or things that actually change the pH and what's called the microbiome in such a way that you may feel better for the moment, but what you've really done is you've taken the body away from its natural state of pH balance and other things that are 100% necessary for you to get the nutrients that you need from your food, to break down the foods properly, and for your body to not start kind of working against it. Itself, which is what we're discovering more often than not, is what's really going on with autoimmune disorders, and which go even beyond the food intolerance. So the food intolerance in a way, which, and to define that a little bit, is a food that just that doesn't work for you for one reason or another. It could be that genetically, you've never actually had the right internal machinery to unpackage that food the best possible way anyway, which means that no matter what you do, it's never going to be a good food for you. But in another way, if it's even that you've been through a stressful part of your life where you were secreting extra cortisol, for example, that will change your internal chemistry. Or let's say that, and I loved that you picked this out the other day when we were working together. You're like, when I see an intolerance to things like spinach and kale, like, why would someone be intolerant to spinach and kale? Well, there's an oxalate issue, right? And some people are more genetically, you know, sensitive to those or others. But without getting too, you know, sciencey on that, it could just be that because you thought those were really healthy, you're really overdoing it. Right, and creating actually an unidentified burden to your body by overdoing a certain healthy food. I did that with almonds several years ago. I was having almond milk with my shakes, also with spinach. I was having almonds for snacks because I thought that that was a healthy protein, you know, thing to do. Suffice it to say that I was way overdoing the almonds, and they popped up. And so by eliminating them after having an MRT test, I just recognized that I needed to pull back on those, and I no longer have a hypersensitivity to those. So the intolerances can exhibit themselves, and this is how I figured it out. Are we allowed to say hail damage?
Yeah, we can do that. Yeah. We can do that.
So I had this extra like 7 or 8 pounds, which is not a lot for most people. But again, in trying to live my brand and trying to talk to my patients through a conversation of authenticity, I have been there. I have had these challenges, and this is how I fixed it. You know, I'm sitting there, literally sitting there on an extra, you know, couple of pounds and some hail damage that I had not had before. And it was identifying that at that time, spinach and almonds were my kryptonite foods, eliminated them, and lost the weight like that. And as it turns out, I was just stimulating my body in a negative way that was making my body hold on to these extra calories because it didn't know what to do with that food. And when your body doesn't know what to do with something, it has a tendency to just try and keep it. And where is it going to keep it? It's going to keep it in the fat. So for most women, that's kind of, you know, in the buttocks. Yes, no. So, you know, just in their thighs and their hips. And in men, it's going to be more central. And one of the problems with a central is that that's a burden to your back from a mechanical standpoint. You know, one of my favorite patients said, "Doc, I know why I have a low back problem. It's because I have a low front problem." Well. It's like my grain storage bin is right here. But, you know, fat is not just a mechanical burden. It's true that carrying extra weight on the front of your spine or, you know, below your hips, which is still a burden to your knees and ankles and feet, is hard on the body. But fat is also in metabolically active inflammatory tissue. It tends to hold all your inflammation chemicals as well. So it's not just that, you know, it's unsightly in some way. It's that it's worthwhile to try and improve your body composition because it's just better for your system. So a food intolerance could mean that you have weight loss intolerance. So you're gaining weight or you're holding on to weight and you can't figure out what's wrong. And more often than not, and I mean way more often than not, identifying these types of food intolerances, which you never would have otherwise recognized, allows you to drop weight almost effortlessly, especially when combined with time-restricted eating and other strategies.
And a great example would be a case that we worked on yesterday where,
yes,
you know, most favorite thing in the world was coffee, yes, and caffeine. And of, yes, course, you know, and probably would never have thought to have eliminated that because it's not one of those that are on the typical list that you would do with an elimination diet. And mm-hmm. yet, big red flag,
right,
on the MRT results.
Not only would she not have thought to have eliminated it, she never would have eliminated
no.
it. Because the one thing that she told me before we tested, she's like, "Dr. B, know you, love you, trust you, but the one thing you can't take away from me is my Starbucks." And the real bummer of it is that I'm a caffeine girl too myself. I will fully admit it. And I was like, "Oh, never fear. No matter how it comes back, we'll be able to figure something out for you." And we will. But sure enough, it's caffeine. So not only would she not have thought of it, she never would have done it because it was the one thing that she really felt sort of almost emotionally bound to. It was a treat for her after working out, doing other things. And also, and I thought this was really sweet, actually, that in the mornings that her husband, when she gets her little her tooth is brushed and she's coming out to the kitchen for the morning for their little routine, there's always a cup of coffee there. And that's his morning, "I love you." So, you know, not only was she not wanting to get rid of it, she's got multiple reasons to really keep that squarely in her space. And the thing is that, you know, the moment we give her something else, you know, was that let's give you this. And I loved the way you put it to her specifically was kind of crowding out the other things. But at a minimum, it's like, let's give you this so that this sneaking out the back door is not remotely so problematic or painful. So that's going to make a huge difference for her because she was topped out into the red with that. I mean, not only was it a sensitivity where it would be pertinent to have the conversation, you know, we really should consider minimizing this. It was so black and white. And so the further, and this is what I tell my patients all the time too, the further you've drifted out to sea, the better you're going to feel to be back on shore. So the fact that it was such a negative for her, once remediated, number one is we're most likely to be able to put it back into her life when we're getting the markers that are telling us that she's no longer responding to it that way. It is most certainly, especially because her caffeine is typically associated with some of the other things that she's intolerant to, you know, one of her big things was holding onto this belly fat that she's never had before. And it was incredibly bothersome to her. And I respect that. That's completely valid. She likes to look good in her clothes and feel good in her own body. And everyone deserves that. And especially if we can test, not guess, and give her all the tools that she needs to build in other sweet things for her husband to give her in the mornings or other treats for things, then all of a sudden we've already done her a huge service that I am confident she would have missed for all time. So I moved away a little bit from something, but I want to say this to your listeners because I think this is really kind of the heart of the issue. Food intolerance is not just weight loss intolerance either. It can be the reason that you, again, never feel like you've really gotten the energy that you felt like you need for the day, which could be that you've got something in that chemical, you know, stew that's preventing you from extracting the nutrients that gives your body the energy that you need to feel really awake and alive and energized and have the energy to do the things that you want to do, but also even to sleep well. If you're not, you know, expending the energy that you need to during the day, oftentimes your body doesn't feel like it needs to sleep as much at night. And then people start developing other bad habits like caffeine to wake up and sleeping medications or other, you know, alcohol even at night to try to go to sleep comfortably. And then you get brain fog, you're not thinking clearly. So I think all of us from time to time have wondered how we found yet another new place to hide our keys. Maybe that's just me.
No, you're not alone in that, Doc. You're not alone. Yeah, and so, but you're right. It does snowball into all of these other effects in various different areas of your life, and then that becomes it's just a whole big, again, rabbit hole that we can fall down with this. But so, all right, people come to you many times though. Their way in is they're looking for treatment for pain, and so they're going, okay, well, weight loss, that's a vanity issue, right? Or like food, what does that have to do with my pain, right? And so talking about that inflammatory burden on the body, yes, and then how that might be adversely impacting the things that you're trying to do to help them with pain.
Absolutely right. And I think, you know, I know that I've at least one-to-one made the confession to you about how I was all the way through medical school residency fellowship when I, you know, heard the lecture on pro-inflammatory foods. And I literally had to reconcile the fact that I understood, like most people do, that if you were going to take an anti-inflammatory drug, it goes in your mouth so that it goes in your GI tract, so that it goes in your bloodstream, so it goes in your system, and it puts wet blankets on all of that inflammation. And while that seems like a good thing on the surface, it's completely ignoring the fact that that's not a dialogue with your body about what inflammation you need and what inflammation you don't need. It is a command for all inflammation, be it good, bad, or ugly, to rid itself from the body, which is actually causes GI problems, renal problems, increases your risk of heart attack and stroke. I mean, the offset to that is so far in the wrong direction. Whereas understanding your body, feeding it what it needs, not putting foods that cause inflammation in your body is really that dialogue that you need to respect your body, and then you start getting the results that you really want, which is you just feel better because you are better.
Well, and I'll put a personal spin on that. So in addition to all of the many other diagnoses that I had, I was coming really close to getting some sort of fibromyalgia, some kind of just a widespread chronic pain, yeah, that I was having in my tissues and really down to my bones. Mm-hmm. And then in addition to that, I had plantar fasciitis. So every morning, mm-hmm, and I slept in not one, I didn't have it in one foot. I had it in both feet. So I slept in two boots, right, which was real sexy and very comfortable. And, you know, and I would put my feet down on the floor in the morning and just this pain. It was terrible. And I was getting injections of cortisone in my heels. And then they were giving me a narcotic pain cream to put on my feet. Right. You know what I did that solved all of that? I did some food elimination and I got rid of gluten and a few other things through some testing. And the next thing you know, Amanda doesn't have all those issues. And so, yeah, it's real pertinent. It's very pertinent to pain.
Absolutely. Well, and, you know, and to take that one step further too, because yours was gluten and some other things too, in addition to her caffeine, pork, which, you know, she enjoys pork steaks as a, you know, as a protein.
What Missourian doesn't? I'm kidding, but yes. Yeah, but I mean, many of us do, right?
Right.
Oh, my husband, if you took his pork steaks away, I think the world would end.
Might be a problem. Well, you know what? Here's the deal. It wouldn't.
I know.
And if he loved his place in the world more before he swapped out the pork steaks, I think, you know, that's the point too. And then you want to tell the listeners about the red dye number 30
for her. Yeah, good one.
Because I thought that was very interesting. And that one hasn't popped up as much, but I think that was really interesting. I'll let you take that one.
So what we were finding was, you know, she popped for red dye number 3 and number 40, I think it was. And, you know, that can be in your lipstick. And, you know, you put that on your mouth every day and then you're ingesting little by little that lipstick over the course of time. You can develop a reaction to that. So it's not just what we put in our mouth intentionally thinking it's food. It's all of the things that we put on our body, you know, toxins in our environment. There are lots of things that we need to consider in terms of inflammation. But yeah.
Absolutely. So great stuff. I was so glad that even though it was about an hour of really talking her through even kind of the emotional side.
And that's a big part of it. Mm-hmm. I know when I found that I had to take some of these foods out of my diet, you know, it affects the way you socialize. It affects your meals with your family. It really impacts a lot of different areas of life. And emotionally, that can be hard. So there's a lot to talk through there and just come up with a plan so that people feel comfortable and safe and ready to go out and take on this challenge, not overwhelmed by it and not like they're alone.
And I loved seeing that you have lived through that yourself. And even in talking to her about just imagining your life sliding back into where it was before you knew. And there's almost nothing that someone could say to you to make you trade the life that you have now for the life that you had then, even though it took a series of other trades that now just aren't even a part of your habits. So they just aren't a part of the way that you live life now now that you're living life. Is what we want for everyone too.
Absolutely. I feel like we could spend a lot more time on this topic, but I wanted to, and I think this is a good setup, right, to talk about, you know, food, lifestyle, these other approaches to people's overall health are super important, especially when we start talking about regenerative therapies and some of the new cutting edge things that you're able to do with people to try and restore health and get people out of pain,
right,
that we don't want to undo with something as simple, quote unquote simple, but I'll air quote that one, as food and these lifestyle changes that we work on through coaching and the restorative side of your practice. So let's talk about orthobiologics is what I have noted here. So we have a few things. Orthobiologics, I think, comes up as a point of interest for people who are in pain.
Yes.
There are also buzzwords around, like, or buzz terms, PRP, stem cells, I think people hear a lot, but nobody really knows what any of these things mean out on the street.
Right.
So Break it down for us. Let's start with orthobiologics.
So orthobiologics is basically using biological materials, so PRP and stem cell, which I'll define, for orthopedic purposes. So if you were going to see an orthopedist, in general, that's for joint pain and injury. It could actually be a joint, but it could be a bone in and of itself. But so many times that the joint problem is really a problem in the tissues around it. So, for example, if someone went to a shoulder specialist, my husband, for example, is a shoulder surgeon, it may not be that the bones themselves have any kind of a problem. It could be that the rotator cuff, which is made up of four different muscles and their tendon insertions, has something wrong with that. So many times what an orthopedic surgeon is really doing is opening up the superficial tissues and seeing what's wrong with the soft and connective tissues in there and fixing those around the bony structures. So, you know, not necessarily rarely, but probably more often than not, what they're really addressing are the things that actually hold the joints together. And only with a fracture or something of that nature are they really addressing a bony problem. So orthobiologics was born out of the understanding that so many of these problems were actually connective and soft tissue problems, not necessarily a problem with the bone. So the idea was, if we could get a tendon, for example, that's actually incompletely torn, so it's just very, very inflamed, very fragile, very brittle, very friable, kind of peeling apart. I like to give people the idea of it being almost like wet tissue paper, and someone's already pulled it apart a little bit, right? But it's still kind of holding on there, and maybe even if you allowed it to dry, it would kind of, you know, settle into itself. But the problem is that we're dynamic human beings, right? We move, so we just keep pulling on that thing. But so if the tissue is already highly inflamed for whatever reason, because it's been traumatized in some way or degenerative in some way, depending on if the person's a smoker or they're older or if they're a baseball player versus playing chess for their sport, those things will all factor into that. But what if we could get the body, kind of harness universal intelligence, get the body to actually be more preoccupied with the way that it's able to heal than continuing to be kind of preoccupied with that, the chemical inflammation? Because once your body and your brain most especially perceives that you've got injury somewhere, it starts behaving much differently. The signals coming up from that joint, from those tissues, are telling the brain, we've got a problem here. And so it can make you guard, especially in the spine, for example, where you get really stiff and you don't want to do anything because every movement hurts. So even though stretching or getting your blood flowing would maybe be the two simple and best things for it, you don't do it because you feel like your body is telling you, no, it's injured. That's a sprained ankle. Don't run on that. And under those circumstances, that's the right thing to do, but not always. So regardless, what we're trying to do is set up a new chemical environment where the body is like, oh yeah, we're injured, but what we need to be doing is healing. And so it starts sending out a different set of signals. So the signaling is really where all of this comes into play. So the body has a tremendous ability to heal itself, to bring in its own reconstruction and repair crews. It just has to believe that that's what it's supposed to be doing. So that's where we kind of harness the ability to actually inject these materials instead of, you know, cutting something open and exposing it and then people spending more time getting over the surgical exposure than they would even of the actual surgical repair deep to the surface tissues. So that's called cell surgery in some places, or orthobiologics. So we're using biologics to do the essentially the work of an orthopedist. When the anatomy, be it a rotator cuff, or this is very, very popular in tennis elbow. So lateral epicondylitis, you know, the outside of the elbow is really tender and every move that you make that's, you know, kind of sweeping something away is like, oh, you know, just
sweet misery. Painful. Yeah.
Yes. Right. A special kind of torture.
Yes.
Yes. Or in the low back, for example. So when the conditions and the proper conditions are identified that look like if this thing would just heal, the person would feel better. And they would have the opportunity to rehab through physical therapy, therapeutic movement, maybe some bracing, making sure the nutrition is dialed in, because we do have to have a system that's ready to respond, right? So, I mean, you can put a beautiful seed into terrible soil and nothing will ever grow, right? And you can have beautiful soil if you put the wrong seed in, that doesn't work either. So it's our job as experts in the field to identify what does the soil look like, what kind of seeds does it need, because we know what kind of garden we want to grow. And if we think there's potential there, then all you can do is till up the soil, give it the nutrients it needs, put the seed where it needs to be, in the sunlight that it needs, water it, all the factors that have to go together, which is sometimes where people think that PRP and stem cells don't work. And you really have to ask yourself the other questions. Did they not work because they were never going to? Did they have the proper support? You know, did it rain for 10 months after this thing was put in it and they never saw the sun? Or was it sunny all the time and it never got water? So there's just a lot of factors, but it's our job as experts to pick to match the soil to the seed and to make sure that we optimize the conditions as much as possible to make sure that it grows what we want it to bloom. With respect to the specific materials that we use, PRP stem cells are really broadly the two things that people, I think, hear a lot about and don't necessarily know what they are. So again, recognizing that really what ultimately they're doing is signaling to the rest of the body. PRP is platelet-rich plasma. It's the simplest and the least expensive of the things that anyone would offer in this space. So it's as simple as drawing the blood from a peripheral source, so vein, and taking a certain amount of volume and spinning it down in a centrifuge, the advantage of which means that all of the growth factors, the parts of that blood that are made by you, for you, to heal you, are all concentrated into this one little layer, which we kind of skim off. And then we, in my practice, using ultrasound guidance or using a fluoroscopic real-time x-ray, deposit those cells directly into the spot where we want that healing to happen. So for example, the supraspinatus in the shoulder, if we knew that there was a partial tear there, it's the kind of thing where historically there was kind of a gap in what you could offer people. You would, you know, tell them either both to rest it, but then also to do PT with it, but then, you know, also just mind your manners with it for a while and hope that it heals. And then if it doesn't, maybe you do some injections of cortisone, which settle down the inflammation, but that doesn't really promote healing. And if that doesn't work, you go to surgery. And the beautiful thing that these orthobiologics do is it puts something in between all of that. You know, ideally to not have to use the steroid, because that can soften those tissues and actually prevent healing. Mm-hmm. But so under these circumstances, you've got essentially a minimally invasive surgery available to you, where you put those cells in and then you do therapeutic movement around that. And kind of rebuild those tissues when they have the advantage of having signaling in the area that's saying, hey, we're healing here. Send us the healing juice, not the inflamed, I'm unhappy juice, right? The overprotective, not good juice. So it brings in other factors. The one thing about PRP, and this would be true of stem cell too, which is very similar in theory, it's just that these cells are taken actually from either the bone marrow, typically from the back of the SI joint, or out of the fat tissue. Very popular with our ladies. They're going to take a little extra of those cells right now. And those two are spun down similarly and injected in the area.
And we're down to about a minute, but
okay,
yes.
I'll go quick.
No, yeah, I want to hear this.
So the nice thing about the stem cells is that those actually can actually direct, they have a bigger bat signal basically than the PRP. So it's just how big of a bat signal do we think that we need, because it's a little bit more invasive, a little bit more expensive, but ultimately it's still your tissues healing you and supported by all the other things that we know that work to put the body in the state of healing itself.
And I'm so glad that you brought that point home and that you shared that, because I think that's a lot of the controversy around stem cells, PRP, et cetera, was, you know, so these are your tissues really making a difference, helping your body to communicate better and to heal. Dr. Kaylee Boutwell-Lenars, thank you so much for joining me again on Get Real to Heal. How can people reach out?
Sure. So we can be found at www.catalyst, it's KATALYSTMD.com. We also have Catalyst Pain Management on Facebook. I have Kaylee Boutwell-Lenars, MD, also on Facebook. Those are my main places for the moment. The Popcast, P-O-P-Cast, Popcast with Dr. Kaylee on YouTube.
And if you're not following her, you should be. And this is Amanda LaPlante. I want to thank you for joining me today on Get Real to Heal. Find me at amandalaplante.com and go make it a great day.